Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey guys, with me today I have Duncan Wardle. He is a creativity and innovation keynote speaker and consultant, and he's got a TEDx talk tonight. 18 minutes or 15 minutes, I'm not sure. Hey Duncan.
Hello, good morning, how are you? Good evening, I'm not sure where you are.
I don't think it matters. Like, half the people will be confused anyways. Be like, oh, probably.
Yeah,
like,
that's true, yeah.
Just finishing up some project, listening to this, I'm like, I don't really know what time it is. But yeah, we spoke a little bit about your TEDx talk. Is that official TEDx, or is it one of these
branches? Oh gosh, I wouldn't know the difference, perhaps I should. It's at the American University of Kuwait, and it is a TEDx. And so I think there's a distinction between a TED Talk and a TEDx. I think TEDx is our sort of a franchise model, I think. But yeah, I'm doing my first one on Saturday in Kuwait, and I'm currently in San Francisco, and I'm dreading, how long could this flight possibly be? But I'm looking forward to the talk. I'm trying to decide if I'm going to go with, I normally always do flip charts. And the reason I do, I draw everything. I hand draw everything for every presentation. A, I never write anything. B, because most of us sit through, 5,000 digital presentations a year. And so we tend to fall asleep by the third slide, even if the topic is interesting. And also, if you use images, it makes damn sure you know your stuff because you've got no bullets to prop you up. And a lot of us are visual learners, and so a lot of people actually learn by seeing. And so images helps the audience as well. So it's, do I go with a flip chart, or do I go with, super terrific slides, which would only be slides of my pictures anyway. But so it depends, because you've got two audiences. You've got the audience in the auditorium, the 120 people that will be there, and you have the audience online. But I like the flips because they're visceral, and you work on them, and I'll work with the audience. And because I think a lot of people, again, are kinesthetic learners. They learn by doing. And again, I just think, how many slide presentations do we sit through during the course of a year, right? So I think I'll go. I'm carrying my flips all the way out to Q8, so hopefully I'll get to use them when I get there.
Yeah, I usually start falling asleep during half the presentations I see. I did see something on your social media page, which... It really stuck out to me, and I kind of went back to it maybe three times, which I usually don't do. And it was the drawing of the house.
Yes, right. So I'm a great believer in a naive. So here's, and again, even if you run small businesses, right, it doesn't matter what you do. We're all an expert at something. All of us. We all have our expertise. We all have our experience. It doesn't matter what you do. I call it your river of thinking. And you're very good at it, and it enables you to make very fast, very quick, very informed decisions. But if you've ever tried to cross a very wide, very fast, very deep river, it's really hard without a boat or rope. Well, your river of thinking is what allows you to make very quick decisions, very informed decisions around your experience. However, when somebody asks you to think differently, getting out of that river of thinking and thinking differently can be really hard for people. So one of the things I have to say, I've been humbled. I lived inside corporate world for 30 years. I worked at Disney for 30 years. I really enjoyed it. But it's still a corporation. It still has its policies and procedures. And diversity was always, talked about in terms of political correctness, which is nonsense. And at first I fell into that, and I thought, and over the last 4 or 5 years when I was heading up the innovation and creativity team there, what I realized was that diversity is innovation. Somebody who thinks differently from you, it's as simple as that, will say something or ask something that makes you think different. And so the way I, the exercise I do with people, it was actually something that was real. I was asked to help our Imagineers design a new retail dining and entertainment complex for Hong Kong Disneyland. So I brought in all the Imagineers, which are the architects and the engineers, but I also thought, I'm going to bring in somebody who thinks differently from them. So I brought in the executive chef of Hong Kong Disneyland. Right. And everybody looked in a bit like, well, what's he doing here? And I said, well, he's very creative. He has to create a new dish. If there's a sauce ingredient missing, if somebody has an allergy, if a plate breaks, if a chef doesn't show up. I mean, this guy is creative and he has to turn it every 3 minutes and make it real. So I gave them 7 seconds to draw an object. And I said, I'd like you to draw a house. And I gave them 7 seconds. And 7 seconds later, in fact, if we pause for the 7 seconds now, but I won't. But if people were listening and just try to draw a house while I'm speaking, 7 seconds from now, you're going to see a square. In the middle of that square at the bottom, you'll see a door. Above the door on either side, you're going to see two windows with a cross over them. And then on top, you'll see a triangle, and that's called the roof. And you think, why? And so all the Imagineers held their images up, and they were all identical. Why? Because our river of thinking has taught us that that's what a house should look like. And so 95% of the drawings in the room looked identical, except one, the chef from Hong Kong Disneyland. He had drawn dim sum architecture, which, of course, needless to say, nobody had seen that one before. But it was, you know, the round bamboo dish that your dim sum comes in. And so it was a round bamboo dish with a pork ball and a shrimp ball on the top with a bit of a chimney and a bit of steam coming off the chimney. Everybody laughed because they realized they had stayed in their river of thinking of what architecture should look like. He had given them permission to get out of their river of thinking. He challenged their river of thinking of what architecture could look like. And instead of considering just standard architecture, you know, who's to say the door always has to be at the front in the middle, right? And he got them to consider audacious architecture. Well, if any brand in the world could consider audacious architecture, right, it'd be Disney. So on the way out of the room at the break, somebody just slapped a post-it note over his picture, and it said, distinctly Disney, authentically Chinese. You know, distinctly Disney was right. Distinctly Disney would be the dim sum architecture, and dim sum, authentically Chinese. Well, 7 years later, the strategic brand position for Shanghai Disney Resort that guided all the architecture, all the soft skills, all the marketing campaigns, etc., was distinctly Disney, authentically Chinese. That became the strategic brand position for Shanghai Disney. The role of the naive expert is not to solve the challenge for you. They won't. They will ask the awkward or embarrassing question that you're too embarrassed to ask or haven't thought of. They will throw out the audacious idea that your years of experience can't let you because you know why that idea won't work. And they will prompt you to think differently. And I will tell you, it works every single time. I had a lady at the call center at Disney. Her name was Mildred. She was 73 years of age. And I brought her into a session where it was a strategic pricing session, otherwise known as how might we make more money. Mm-hmm. And I was just chatting to Mildred, and I asked the 5 people from the call center, and I was asked, they were going to send me a couple, three or four execs. And I said, well, no, that's great, but you know what, could I have people who actually answer the phone, please? And they're like, why? I said, well, who do you think knows what the guest wants? The people who sit in their air-conditioned offices with their cappuccinos, or the people who spend, and by the way, I was guilty as charged, or the people who spend 8 hours a day chatting to them. And so I sat next to Mildred. She was 73 years of age. She was semi-retired. She comes in 3 days a week to answer the calls, and she does it because she likes the company. Hmm. And I said, well, what don't you like about your job? She goes, oh, I don't like it. If it looks like they're not going to book or convert, I have to get on to the next call. I was like, oh. And I said, I get it from a business perspective, right? But you could see Mildred would like to chat for like hours over a cup of tea. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, and also sometimes they don't trust me. I said, oh, good God, what? You're the cutest grandmother on the planet Earth. You work for the Walt Disney Company. What do you mean they don't trust you? She says, oh, well, if they're looking at our website and we have an offer, and let's say it's if you book by February the 10th, you get a free character breakfast. If they don't mention that offer first in that specificity, I'm not allowed to mention it. And I said, what? She goes, oh, yeah, it's called guest request, don't suggest. I said, what? She goes, well, I don't know what it means. She didn't know what it meant. She just knew that if the guest didn't mention the offer on the website first, she couldn't. You know, it was company policy that she wouldn't. And I was like, oh, that sounds a bit odd. So I went off to meet the head of strategic pricing. I said, well, tell me about guest request, don't suggest. And he said, oh, that's worth millions of dollars in incremental revenue. And I said, oh, well, it doesn't feel right. I said, look, I can't run your dilution models for you. I'm no financial guru. But Mildred reckons, because I'd asked her, I said, how many people do you think you could book if you're outside of the policy? She reckons, oh, I reckon I could get 3 or 4. So I asked permission for a pilot. I said, I'd like to take Mildred and the 4 colleagues with her here today out of the policy for 6 weeks, and let's just see how they do. And sure enough, all of them were booking 3 or 4 out of 20. And so the policy, guest request don't suggest, went away. And we earned a lot more money. And again, it was just about having somebody who would say something or make you think differently. And no executive would have got to that, because no executive would have known what the rules of sitting in the call center were, because they hadn't sat on a call. She sat on hundreds. And so she challenged our thinking. Again, she didn't come up with a recommendation. That's not her role. The role of the naive expert is, again, to ask the silly, audacious question or throw out the audacious idea to get you out of your river of thinking and thinking differently.
You know, this is super hard for these big corporate types, but I think it's also super hard for small business and solopreneurs. Because in a small business, you usually have a boss and a team. The team is, you know, scared to say much stuff to the boss because, you know, he's the boss. There's not really, you know, that big company there, you know, everyone. And then a solopreneur, like, you know, he can't really get outside the box and give himself new ideas if, you know, he's stuck with his old ideas.
Well, so I would encourage the solopreneur to walk out. So there's plenty of Starbucks in the world. There's plenty of co-collaborative workspaces. There's WeWorks. The solopreneur has friends. He has a grandmother, or she has a grandmother. They may have an aunt, an uncle, a sister, a brother, a friend who works in a different industry, and just sit down and have a call. Again, it's about somebody who will just come at it from a different perspective from you, who will challenge your thinking. So for a solopreneur, I think it's probably easier. Yes, if you're in a small organization and you've only got one boss, but I've actually created a set of tools that actually enable you to get past that. So for example, let's say you've got all of your ideas, right? Normally when you're in a brainstorm or an ideation session, you've got all of your ideas up on the wall and everybody gets the red pen and they get to put their dot next to the two or three ideas they like. And, you know, everybody waits to see what the senior person's going to do, right? And we all, they put their dot on idea 17. And so what do? We line up like little soldiers. Oh, my God, yeah, I love that idea, right? We're all guilty. And so we've abandoned that. And so I hated it when we created this new tool, because I used to be the senior person in the room and people used to have to line up behind me, and they didn't anymore. Nobody likes my ideas. No. We gave people post-it notes. And we would number the ideas on the walls. Let's say we've got 54 ideas. They're all numbered. People were given 3 post-it notes each. And they were asked to walk the walls. It was called a briefed in as an introverted exercise. So you couldn't talk because people would influence each other. And once they'd read all the ideas, they were asked to write down the corresponding 3 numbers of 3 ideas they were the most passionate about. Then they give those post-it notes to a facilitator. Facilitator puts them up on the wall, so the facilitator acts as Switzerland. And suddenly you get a very quick visual representation of where the passion of the team is. And let me tell you why that's important. One of the big barriers to innovation for any small organization or a big one is ideas get stuck, diluted, or killed as they move through to execution, right? You start with this big idea, and by the time it gets through all the processes that it needs to go through, all the regulatory, all the stuff you go through, they get stuck, diluted, or killed because people aren't passionate about them. And if you're not there when it goes off to get executed, you know, and if people aren't passionate about it, that's when it starts to get diluted. So you want to find out where the passion of the team lies first, and that tool does that for you. And there's another tool that actually enables people to look at it. It's very ideas, right? Are the most subjective thing on the planet. Let's say you like pink, and you come up with a pink idea, I've come up with a green idea, and Sally's come up with a blue idea. Well, clearly, the pink idea in your mind is the best. I'm thinking, oh, hell no, it's not. It's the blue one. And Sally's thinking, no, it's the green one. Because ideas are subjective. So how do you take subjectivity off the table when it comes to ideas and put objectivity on the table? Well, so all you do is you create your success criteria in advance. And let's say you've got, and I wouldn't pick more than 4 or 5. It just makes it more complicated than needed. You draw a star, and you put like a starfish, and you've got on each prong, you put your success criteria. One might be, is it aligned with our goals? Is it a strategic brand fit? Does it align for what we stand for as a brand or as me as a company? That could be one. Another one is it embedded in consumer truth? Is it relevant to the audience I'm going after? That could be another one. Another one, and then the rest are, you know, interchangeable. It could be, does it drive lots of news coverage? Will it drive X sales in 12 months? And can I get it executed in 12 months? Let's say those are our success criteria. The two that I never change, by the way, because I always have them, are, is this a strategic brand fit? Is it aligned with who we stand with as a company, as a brand? And then is it embedded in consumer truth? And I'll go around, and each little prong has three. Does it do it a medium amount, a small amount, a medium amount, a big amount? And you so and you just so let's say consumer truth. It does this idea. Is it absolutely embedded in what this particular consumer is looking for? A small amount, a medium amount, or a big amount? And the bigger, the more it aligns with the criteria, the further out on the star you draw. And then you just put dots on each one. And then you join the dots. It's, remember when you were a kid, you joined the dots. And suddenly you get a very quick, again, visual representation because you take each idea. So let's say you started with 54 and you vote with your heart. And suddenly you get down to about eight ideas that the team are really passionate about. You go, okay, that's great. But how do we know which one's good for the business and which one's good for the consumer? Then you use this second tool with those eight ideas. And you use a different color for each idea. And suddenly you've got a starfish in eight different colors, and one starfish is a whole lot bigger than the others. And suddenly you go, okay, this is the one that is embedded in consumer truth, aligned with our brand fit. We can execute it in 12 months. It's going to drive lots of news coverage, and we believe it will meet our sales goals. And it takes all of the subjectivity off the table. And I've seen the most senior people in the meeting back off their idea that they were the most passionate about because they realized it was embedded in consumer truth. So, for example, for a nice chap at Disneyland Paris, quite mad but quite lovely, he was the executive vice president. And so he believed that a cowboy festival would be a big idea. And so, but don't forget, Disneyland Paris's target audience is mums with toddlers. Right. So, and these mums are probably 30, 32. And you just think, yeah, I'm with you, mate, because I too am old and I love cowboys. But guess what? 32-year-old mums with toddlers probably don't even know what a cowboy is. And so he had to kill his own idea. And so there are some tools that actually enable you to get past hierarchy that can get you to a good place.
Yeah, this seems like a good tool for bigger organizations. But I'll tell you, I've seen a company that I used to work for mess it up so bad. What they did, it was kind of similar to what you're saying, is they took three ideas from each one of us, which maybe it was like 20 or 30 people, to come up with a purpose-driven mission statement, right? And what they did is they wrote every single idea that we had, and they did not kill any of them. They combined it. So at the end, it was a mission statement.
And then you have a frank... the kitchen sink. So we do have a tool that takes out the kitchen. We're all guilty of the kitchen sink. Where our mantra is, if in doubt, break it out. If you think it's a slightly different idea, capture it on a separate piece of paper. Because so here's a trick to keep you focused on to help address that one, mate. So most of us live in the world of no because, right? We know a thousand reasons why something might not work because our years of experience tell us, right? So you've got the no becauser who's constantly in there saying, oh, no, we tried that last year. Well, we'll never get that past legal. Oh, it's not a strategic brand fit. And then you've got the yes aura. And this is the person who's incredibly annoying. They're the person who's not listening to a word you're saying. And they go, oh, yes, I love that idea. Oh, my God. Or, and then they just throw their idea. And you wait, did you not listen to a word I said? and we're all guilty of that. We come into an idea session. We've all got our idea. And we tend to talk over one another because we're so desperate to be heard. So if I'm running an ideation session, A, I brief it in advance, and I'll talk about the importance of that in just a minute. But B, I just put some music on for the first 10 or 15 minutes, and I ask people to write down their ideas that they've got in their head, and then I ask them to report them out. Because once they've been heard, my idea, they relax, and they listen, and they contribute, and they collaborate because they've been heard. So that can help. But just the simple use of the words, yes and. Yes and will stop no becauses in their tracks because when you say yes and to something, you have to build on it. And so somebody says, ooh, let's do a new, let's build a, oh, I know, let's do a, we're looking for ideas for a new seasonal festival at Disney to drive attendance. Ooh, yes and, let's do it on May the 4th because, you know, May the 4th be with you. Ooh, yes and. Let's do what if we did an intergalactic food and wine festival? Ooh, yes, and what if we crowdsource the recipes? Ooh, yes, and suddenly it becomes, so yes, and does a couple of things. When you get two people in a room and you ask them to practice yes, and if you just say you've got $10,000 for tonight's party, what could you do? Throw out an idea and have the next person say yes, and then you say yes, and they say, and the first two words out of your mouth have to be yes, and because it stops you behaving like a no-becauser, because we all do it. Right. When you ask, if you try that exercise, I promise you three things will happen. One, the idea will become bigger, not smaller. When you stop and ask those two people at the end of the exercise, whose idea was it? They'll turn, they'll pause for a moment, and they'll go, ours. The moment you can transfer the power of my idea to our idea, whether you're a small organization or a big one, is the moment you accelerate its opportunity to get done. The other thing that yes and does is it stops the yes orers in their tracks. Because if we're building on a Star Wars idea and I go yes and, I can't say, oh, let's do gardening. Your brain doesn't work that way. And it forces you to stay on the same idea, which stops you from coming up with where we started, which was I call the Frankenstein idea, where everything's thrown into the kitchen sink. And by using yes and, it keeps it a little bit more focused. And back to that piece about why you brief in a couple of days in advance. Actually, I'm going to ask you. So I know you're on the phone, so I'm going to have to trust you. But close your eyes for just a second. And I'm going to ask you a question. I don't want you to think about it. I want you to just shout out whatever first comes into your head. Where are you and what are you doing usually when you get your best ideas? Oh, you're thinking about it too hard.
It's
supposed
not...
to answer. You're thinking about it too hard. Just what is it? Where are you and what are you doing when you get your best ideas?
Okay. I was thinking, my first thoughts were just, I'm at the desk, and with the ideas, I started laying in bed.
Perfect. Laying in bed, perfect. You're here, shower, running, jogging, walking the dog, commuting, drinking a glass of wine, about to fall asleep, about to wake up. You'll hear everything. Here's what you won't hear at work. I've trained 5,000 people. You never hear it, not once. And then, so now, what I want you to do now is I want you to close your eyes again. And I want you to picture the last verbal argument that you were in with somebody. And when you've got it, I don't want to know about it. I just want you to tell me you can see it.
Yeah, I can see it.
All right. So, Fred, I can't stand you. You son of a bitch. You blind copied my boss on that email. You threw me under the bed. I'll never, ever work with you again. I hate you. And you stomp out of the office because you're really angry. You slam the door. You're just so pissed off at Fred. And then you get in the car. And you drive over to the local coffee shop, and it's 5, maybe 10 minutes after the argument's over. Grab a cappuccino, sit down in the armchair, begin to relax a bit, and what just popped into your head?
That was interesting.
What just popped? Well, okay. So, but I tell you, the other thing that somebody's going to say is, the thing I wish I'd said. I'm like, yeah, the killer one liner. The one that, oh my God, if I'd have said that, if I'd have said that, I'd have totally landed this. I'd have won the argument. And it's the perfect one-liner. And it always comes to you 5 or 10 minutes after the argument. You're always really frustrated. You say, shit, why didn't I think of it during the argument, right? And so here's what happens in an argument. When during an argument, your brain is the same as it is at work. It's in what I call busy beta. It's defending itself. And you hear yourself say, I don't have time to think. And when you're at work, you're doing emails, you're doing presentations, you're on the phone, you're doing pitches, you're reading, you're talking, and you hear yourself say, I don't have time to think. When you don't have time to think, when you don't give yourself time to think, you can't kill up with that. You never come up with a killer one-liner during the argument. You never come up with a big idea at work. You're like, And so, if you practice the art of playfulness, and it's important to be playful when you're ideating, you can put, I'll run an energizer at the beginning of an ideation session, and all I'm listening for is laughter. And it's creativity gets a bad rap because so often it's like lots of color pens and sharpies. That's bullshit. But if it's creativity with purpose, I'm listening for laughter. Why am I listening for laughter? Because the moment I've got laughter, I know metaphorically I've placed you back in the shower, walking, running, driving, and I know you can have big ideas. Because 13% of your brain is conscious. 87% is subconscious. And the door between your conscious and subconscious brain when you're stressed and busy at work is closed. And that's why you can't come up with that killer one line or the big idea. But the moment you relax a bit, you're in the shower, the door between your conscious and subconscious brain opens. 87% of your brain, you don't use it during the day. You go around making, and that 13% allows you to make informed and educated decisions, but it doesn't allow you to think differently because you can't access all that stimulus out the back. Every bicycle ride you've ever been on, every person you've ever kissed, even the ones you choose to forget that pop up on Facebook every now and then, every colouring you've ever done, it's all there to create unforced connections back to a challenge. But you need to be able to access it. And some people access it. I think you've, did you say about to fall asleep or about to wake up?
I don't think so. I just said laying in bed.
Oh, okay. Well, so laying in bed. So I would argue you're just about to fall asleep or just about to wake up. But it could just be laying. So do you know the expression when the penny drops?
Yeah.
It's that eureka moment where, oh my God, I've got a big idea. It came from Thomas Edison. He used to sit in an armchair at night and fall asleep. But he would fall asleep. He had a penny between his knees. He'd have his knees together and have a tin tray on the floor. As he would fall asleep, his muscles would relax. The penny would drop. It would hit the tin tray on the floor. He would wake up and he would write down whatever he was thinking. And again, Thomas Edison, not an unsuccessful inventor. Dali, Salvador Dali, same thing. He would fall asleep against the needle. And then he would fall over as he fell asleep. That would clearly wake him up. And he would sketch whatever he was dreaming. Of course, I want to know what he was smoking before he went to bed. But he's not an unsuccessful artist either. So people who get their best ideas while they're laying in bed, while they were about to wake up or about to fall asleep, keep a notepad by the bed and write them down. And so, so that's why I brief in 2 or 3 days in advance of the session, because 2 or 3 days in advance of the session, people, at least hopefully, will have a shower, they'll walk the dog, they'll go running, they'll go driving, they'll commute, they'll lay in bed, and they'll come to the session with those ideas. But don't forget, spend those first 5 or 10 minutes having them write them. Just put on a piece of music. Oh, music, very important. Controls the energy of a room. If I'm briefing something in, I turn it off. But the moment they go into ideation, I put it on, because you'll notice a significant difference in energy in the room when you play music.
Yeah, I agree. I have different tracks I use for different things. You know, like I have my gym soundtrack, my work soundtrack. Like I have a lot of different ones. I agree with that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the one thing you mentioned about arguments, and it's, I think I deal with arguments a little differently than a lot of people, because most arguments to me are not serious. Most of them, you know, it's like a disagreement. Agreed. Right? So I use it almost as a test for improv comedy, you know, and some people don't know how to react to that. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. No, I think improv is a great way of getting people again to think differently. And so improv is, it's an offer, right? You're given a line, and you have to come up with a line that matches to it. And that's the same as an ideation session. You're given an offer. Can you build on it? And think of other ideas as an offer. And if you treat them as an offer, you think, oh, yes, and where might I take that? Another word that help brief in and get people to think differently is just by, instead of saying, oh, do you think we could do this? Or I would say, how might we? How might we? It's very invitational. It helps to get people out of their traditional, oh, no, we'll never make that work.
Yes, it's true. Plus the arguments I can't win. I do my best to just ignore afterwards. So it's one of these things where I either like mess with someone a little bit, or I just ignore, you know, because I don't know.
I mean, I think the other thing is there's a tool that allows you to challenge the rules, because a lot of us are guided by rules, right? And so there's a really useful tool that helps people think differently. You just list the rules of your challenge as quickly as you can. Then you ask, what if those rules didn't apply, and imagine a world where I could actually make that happen. So think about Blockbusters back in the day, right? Everybody went to Blockbusters to get their video. And so what were the rules? Well, the rules were limited store hours, limited store stock of video, never get the one you want on opening day weekend, had to be kind and rewind, had to have a membership card, had to return it on time, had to drive to a physical store, had to pay a late fee. And Reed Hastings, who was the founder of Netflix, he used this tool. He listed all the rules of going to Blockbuster. And he took one rule. What if there was no physical store? Well, imagine a world where I might make that happen. Well, wait a minute. YouTube already exists. Well, they stream content. They stream amateur content. Oh, wait. Well, what if I just stream franchise content? Oh, wait. So if I stream franchise content, nobody would have to drive to a physical store. Nobody would have to be kind and rewind. I'll cut the rental off at 24 hours so nobody gets a late fee. And everybody gets the one they want on opening day weekend. It's open 24. Oh, I know. I'll call it Netflix. He took it to Blockbusters 5 times. They turned him down 5 times. He took them out of business in 5 years. Now, a lot of people go, oh, well, that's Netflix. They're big. I'm an individual entrepreneur. How could I ever do that? Well, it was a small company in Nottingham in England. You know, they were like 24 employees. They used to make glasses, and they would wrap the glasses and ship them out. And they found on the production floor, when it came to the wrapping and packaging, they broke lots of glasses, and the production wasn't as fast as they wanted. So they went down to the shop floor, and they observed what was going on. And they listed all the rules. Okay, had to have employees, had to have packers, had to have a cardboard box, had to have newspaper, had to have a conveyor belt, had to have glasses. And one of the rules they wrote down that they noticed was the employees were reading, it was newspaper they were packing the glasses in because newspaper's free. So they saved on packaging material, and actually newspaper's quite good for packaging glass. But one of the rules they wrote down was that the employees were reading the paper. Mm-hmm. And so, but then the deliberate what if question, which again, if it's not provocative, it will not get you, you will iterate, not innovate. Somebody immediately asked the provocative what if question, and they said, ooh, what if we poke their eyes out? Well, A, that's not very nice. B, it's against the law. But because somebody had said it, the person sitting next to them, she said immediately, oh, wait, let's hire blind people. And they did. Breakage went down 50%, production went up 8%, and they got a 50% salary subsidy from the British government just because somebody had the courage to ask the provocative what if question. You're not going to do it, but it gives you, it's a tool that enables you to challenge the rules. Walt Disney, back in 1940, he created Fantasia, and it wasn't very successful, but he wanted it to mist during drip, 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 little April showers. He wanted heat pumped in during Night on the Bare Mountain, so he didn't own the movie theaters. So he listed all the rules of showing his movie in a movie theater. It's dark, it's dirty, I can't control the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, ooh, what if I could control the environment? Well, that's a pretty provocative what if in 1940, because he didn't own the theaters. He said, well, imagine a world where I might. Okay, well, I don't own the movie theater, so all I have to do then is, what if I took my movies out of the theater? Well, that was an absurd question, right? Because you wouldn't be able to see them. Then where would you screen them? They're only two-dimensional. They're all over. And he said, well, wait a minute. Imagine a world where I might. But if I took my movies out of the theater, they couldn't be two-dimensional. Well, I'd have to make them three-dimensional. Well, if I make them three-dimensional, I'd have to have characters to walk around. Well, if I had a character to walk around, the princesses can't live next to the pirates because people wouldn't be immersed in the story. Well, then I'd have to create different lands. Ooh, I know. I'll call it Disneyland. And created probably the single biggest creative invention of the 20th century, Disneyland, which opened on July 17th, 1955, just by asking the what-if question. So we recently, you know, the barriers to coming to Disney are, I can't afford it, I want to wait till my kids are the right age, and suddenly about 8 or 9 years ago, this young upstart online book-selling company called Amazon appeared, and we're like, oh, who are they? What do they do? Oh, they're no threat to our business. We're in the theme park business. Well, sure enough, within 5 years, Amazon had taught the consumer they didn't have to wait for anything anymore. So the consumer said to us, hey, we don't want to stand in line. You're like, wait, what? That's our business model. What do you mean you don't want to stand in line? Get back in line. And so we use this tool. Right? What are the rules of going to Disney theme park? Have to buy a ticket, have to get on a plane, have to get a car rental, have to stand in line, have to buy popcorn, have to go on the ride, have to stand in line. And we asked, what if there were no lines? Well, that was an absurd suggestion in 2008. And we said, well, wait a minute. What if there was no line for front desk? What if there was no gate at the front of the park? What if you could get on your favorite attractions without waiting? What if you could buy your food without waiting? What if you could buy your merchandise without waiting? Well, and we said, imagine a world where we might make that work. Well, sure enough, RFID technology already existed. So we said, well, what if we just put an RFID chip in your wristband? Now, that wristband, the Disney Magic Band, fast forward to today, it's your room key. You just touch a door, you go in. It is your theme park ticket. You swipe and go. It has your reservations for your favorite attractions, your favorite characters embedded in it. You don't wait for those. If you tap an item or merchandise once, it goes to your hotel room. You tap it twice, it goes to your house. Imagine the per caps on that.
Right.
If you walk into Pinocchio's Village House and you've already booked and saved your I want my hot dog with the pickles on the side on your smartphone, you're now there. The restaurant knows you're there. You touch table 47. The food comes fresh to you. On average, the guest now has 2 hours free time a day. What do we do with our free time? We spend money. Single biggest revenue driver, incremental revenue driver of anything we've done in Disney parks for years. Oh, but wait, no capital investment required. Well, I mean, yes, there was, but not the price of a new attraction or a new firework show or a new parade. And so, but by giving something of real value to the consumer, i.e., oh, you don't have to stand in line anymore. The consumer's like, here, let me give you my firstborn, i.e., my data, right? So now, real time, everybody's talking about big data. This is real time data. This, I know where you are. I know how long the wait is and the ride you're on. But I also know your daughter's favorite character, Cinderella. She's standing 50 yards away, and I can text you and tell you. Think about the guest experience then. Think about everything they touch everywhere they go. If I put Buzz Lightyear at 5 feet in a shop, I know how many units I sell per hour because the magic band's touching him. If I put him at 3 feet, I might triple that. And so real-time operational decisions, but long-term products and services, the consumer's telling us every minute of every day what they want, what they like, and what they don't like, and that will inform every single product and service that Disney creates in the future. Just by starting with the absurd what if there were no lines?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Also, the Walt Disney autobiography that came out recently was just great. I really liked it. I had no idea how much stuff he went through.
Which one?
Let me see. I would have to look on Amazon. But I read one last year, and it was just, it was mind-blowing.
Oh, I didn't know there was a recent one. Oh, you'll have to let me know. I have not seen a recent one.
Yeah, so I'll message
you. I'm off to Pixar in a minute. I'm quite excited. I'm in San Francisco, and I'm going over to see a couple of mates of mine over at Pixar, which is kind of fun, because you want the cradle of creativity. That's it. But you know what? There's 21 full-service bars on that campus. You know, I could be creative with 21 full-service bars.
That's true. Well, I'll link out in the show notes, and then I'll message it to you too. But yeah,
please.
The book was great. Yeah. And Duncan, where can people find you?
They can find me at duncanwardle.com. So it's not D-U-N-K-I-N, which Starbucks would have you believe. It's it's D-U-N-C-A-N and then W-A-R-D-L-E.
I don't know why. When I heard the word Duncan, just period, I think of Home Alone. The guy that owned the toy store.
Well, so other people will think of donuts or yo-yos. So I guess that's okay too.
Yeah, although he had that toy store, right? Where Kevin was hiding.
God, I'd forgotten about that. Well, actually, the reason I was named Duncan. Duncan was the first king of Scotland.
Okay.
He was killed by Matt Best on page 3.
There you go, man. Well, it's been great.
So if anybody goes, I'm stuck on this. Have you got any ideas? I'm not going to charge you. I'll just kick around an idea. Why not? Especially if you're an entrepreneur. Just pick up the phone. Let's kick some stuff around. You know, nothing lost, right? Ideas are cheap, as they say.
Yeah, it's the execution, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Liebel. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.